I'm going to talk today about the neurobiology of anxiety and autism and common endophenotypes between anxiety and autism. And I'll give you a quick overview. It's nice to give this talk after getting so much rich information about what anxiety is and autism. I'm going to jump right to brain stuff. I'm going to talk a bit about how affective neuroscience informs ASD neuroscience. Then I'm going to present very briefly some preliminary data suggesting that when you look at anxiety and autism in the neurobiology of autism, you can get some traction and explain some variability. And then I'm going to talk about some future directions and considerations. Okay, so the take-home message of this talk is that anxiety and autism share overlapping neural systems, and it's often puzzled me that there hasn't been more studies directly addressing this issue. There's considerable overlap, as I'm going to describe. And what this means is that a consideration of anxiety and affect may actually help us to understand the ASD, the core ASD endophenotype, I would argue. Now, there's a couple other big picture points I want to make here. And I'm going to make a pitch for biomarkers, which is what I do, but because of the tools I use. But I happen to think when thinking about anxiety and autism, we have reason to really want to look at biomarkers, because we're talking about an internalizing state, and we know that kids with autism have a hard time verbalizing that. So I'm going to talk a bit more about this in a second, but it's an area where the pursuit of a biomarker actually is, to my eyes, makes a lot of sense, and for that matter, it may wind up being a sensitive and specific marker of treatment outcome as well. So it's important to consider anxiety in the neurobiology of autism, I would argue. Now, I'm going to get a little theoretical here in thinking about this. There's one of the things that's so interesting to me is there's such a rich tradition of studying emotion in psychology. And sometimes I feel like in the field of autism research, we're sometimes digging up questions that, you know, the field of emotion research has dealt with years ago. I mean, looking back at Paul Mill's work in the 40s, talking about this idea of a hypothetical construct. What we're facing when we're talking about anxiety and studying emotion is a fundamental problem. You can't touch anxiety, you can't see anxiety, you can't taste it. It's a hypothetical construct. You have to infer its presence, and in the language of Paul Mill, you do it via intervening variables. And this is important to consider, because we are limited in the channels in which we can get information about anxiety in general, as well as in autism. And again, there's a rich tradition of considering this in anxiety disorders. Going back to the work of Peter Lang in the 70s and 80s, talking who conceptualized this tripartite model of anxiety measurement, where as he posited, there are three ways we can know someone is anxious. One of them is through behavior, one of them is through self-report, verbal report, and one of them is through psychophysiology. Now again, getting back to the biomarker piece, all three of these are problematic in autism. It's verbal report, we know, is a limitation of kids with autism. Overt behavior, there's lots of overt behaviors in autism, and it's very difficult to discern which may be related to anxiety and which are related to the core symptoms of autism. So there's a lot of noise in that signal, if you will. And then psychophysiology, including imaging, again, this is my bias, I think it's a very interesting tool to use, but there are problems there as well. It can be very hard, I'm going to talk about this later, it can be very hard to get a good read of some of these psychophysiological variables. But we have to infer the presence of anxiety in these kids somehow. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about anxiety, the anxiety disorders and the neuroscience of anxiety disorders in a field called affective neuroscience, as they dub themselves. It's really interesting, in the past 10 years or so, there's been a real convergence, probably more so than in the field of autism, on a specific set of brain structures that are involved in anxiety. And I'm going to outline those brain structures, and I'm going to try to look at synergies between what we know about those brain structures and anxiety, and then what we know about them in autism. So I'm going to briefly describe these. Most of you in this audience may be familiar with the amygdala as an emotion structure. This has been known about for a long time. Initially, the amygdala was conceptualized as a part of the brain that is involved in fear and negative emotions. Of course, it is that, but we now know, at least in humans, it probably has a much broader role in the processing of both positive and negative emotions. And it's often talked about these days in the affective neuroscience community as being a sort of surveillance serving a surveillance function, monitoring the environment for social and emotional information, and then coordinating a person's biological system to respond to those events. It's a much more complicated picture than in humans than it often seems to be at first glance. So the affective neuroscience community is pretty clear on the fact that anxiety is associated with increased activity in the amygdala.
Right. Was your amygdala?
Yeah. Okay. So the prefrontal cortex piece of the story is a bit newer. Well, that's not true. If you look at, what was it, Phineas Gage, who lost his frontal cortex in the 19th century and became emotionally dysregulated. We know that prefrontal cortex is involved in emotion. And we know that a number of different parts of prefrontal cortex are involved in emotion. And actually, it's sort of the cutting edge of the field of affective neuroscience, in part, is trying to address the unique contributions of areas of prefrontal cortex and emotion. I'm not going to go there. I'm just going to talk about a couple particular brain areas. That happened to be related to autism. One of them is ventromedial prefrontal cortex, it's a hard word to get out, which we know is involved in fear learning and regulation of emotion. And this becomes very important. The most common narrative these days in affective neuroscience of anxiety is that you have the amygdala, you have prefrontal cortex, and you have the two communicating one another. It's sort of boiling it down to simple terms. You have the amygdala, which is an affective structure, which is being regulated by prefrontal cortex. So the connections between them become important. And for that matter, taking that a step further, one can think of affect as this sort of balance between countervailing forces, these basic emotion responses and our ability to use prefrontal cortex mechanisms to inhibit those responses. So again, like I said, actually there's a fair amount of convergence in the affective neuroscience community about these structures, and it's a pretty exciting area of research. Like I said, there are other areas of prefrontal cortex. One I'm going to mention, ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, which is a part of the brain that's thought to be involved in rapid orientation to threat. And there's some nice work from Danny Pine at NIH showing in both kids and children with anxiety disorders that you show increased activity in this area, which is thought to reflect this rapid orienting to threat, which we know can exacerbate anxiety symptoms. So affective neuroscience of anxiety. Now, again, many of you will probably be familiar with an amygdala account of autism, so I'm going to transition into that. The amygdala figures prominently in a lot of neurodevelopmental models of autism, and has for some time. I'm going to talk mostly about imaging studies of this, because I'm going to show you some data later that speak to some of what I'm going to talk about with respect to imaging. But there have been a large number of studies in the past 10 years that have documented decreased activity in the amygdala. I'm mentioning Simon Varenkoen's study here just mainly because it's early. A number of papers showing the same things in the 2000s. Decreased activity in the amygdala. It fits really nicely with this narrative of autism being associated with social anhedonia, sort of decreased amygdala activity. We know that the amygdala is involved in social reciprocity, so you would expect decreased activity there in folks with autism. Now, the picture has become a lot more complicated, particularly in the past 5 to 7 years. A pretty influential paper came out, Kim Dalton in 2005, that showed increased activity in the amygdala. And if you're raised in this tradition of the amygdala being sort of functionally offline in autism, you start scratching your head at this. Why would you see hyperactivity in this area? Now, since then, there have been a number of other studies that have shown the same thing. Well, I mean, not a large number. I think the balance is still weighted in favor of hypoactivation if you look across studies, I think. But two studies by Chris Monk's group at University of Michigan, and actually one study which I should have put on here but didn't, a nice study by Natalia Kleinhans a couple years ago that showed a correlation, positive correlation between amygdala activity and symptoms of social anxiety. So there are these increasing findings of hyperactivation of amygdala in autism. What do you do with this? So I'm hopefully not going to belabor this point too much, but it's sort of the crux of what I want to get across to you, is there's this conundrum in thinking about these emotion circuits in autism, and here it is. We know that autism and anxiety are related. We know that rates of anxiety are elevated in autism. Pretty clear. You can debate how much and whether it's co-occurring or comorbid, but the bottom line is there's an association there, most people think. We know that anxiety is associated with amygdala function, and in a pretty clear direction. You predict increased amygdala activity among folks with anxiety. We know that autism is associated with abnormal amygdala function as well. but not upwards. We normally would predict downwards, right? So again, hopefully I won't belabor this too much, but if you go to the upper part of the triangle, you would predict an increase, but if you go to the lower part, you'd predict a decrease, and as a result, you're left scratching your head. So I think in general, I mean, as someone in this field, this in my mind is, I'm going to describe a sort of, not even a hypothesis about this, but sort of a roadmap about how we might start to understand this. I think we're, it's amazing how the amygdala has been studied for so long, and yet there's some basic properties of how it functions in humans that I think we need to get a handle on. So I'm going to put out, I wouldn't even call it a hypothesis about how to resolve this conflict. I guess I'd call it a roadmap. I think we need to accept the fact that the amygdala is a brain structure that does many things, or at least a certain number of things, and that some of them happen to be seemingly contradictory, and that when you're measuring the amygdala in someone with autism, you're actually measuring a kind of hybrid signal. And what I mean by that is we know that the amygdala is associated with what you might call approach functions, pro-social behaviors. There's some debate about how much really is associated with that, but there's general agreement. And then we know it's associated with what you could call avoidance behaviors, anxiety. How can one part of the brain do this? It's sort of, there's this weird reductionist sort of thought problem. I think the answer may have something to do with arousal. You can try to subsume both the approach and the avoidance tendencies of the amygdala under this general construct of arousal. It gets, you know, people get switched on to their environment. Maybe they'll approach it, maybe they'll avoid it. And that's that's not a hypothesis I'm making up. The idea the amygdala being a valence, non-specific arousal mechanism is something that's out there and debated. But the roadmap I have going forward in thinking about this is it's possible that you can have an amygdala dysfunction that leads both to social anhedonia, that leads either to social anhedonia or fear. And note that the behavior in any given person might be the same. If you're avoiding a certain behavior, it's either because you're not interested or it's spooking you, probably. Whether or not in a given kid you see social anhedonia without fear, or fear and probably some social anhedonia as well, given that this is autism, it could be that this is an individual difference variable. So this is where my mind is at in thinking about this. But it's critical, again, we have this mixed picture of amygdala signal and autism. What I'm going to argue in the next couple slides is if you start thinking about anxiety, the picture gets a little bit clearer. The picture is always always confusing when you're studying neuroimaging of autism. But okay, so I'm going to talk through very quickly some data slides. There have been very few studies. In fact, I think there's only been two studies I'm aware of that have looked at amygdala function in autism and formally considered anxiety. One of them is the Wang paper I mentioned in the previous slide, and one of them is that paper by Natalia Kleinens. I may be missing some, but I think that's it. So what our group has done is started to look at this more formally. Now, Larry mentioned and Connor mentioned a number of issues related to assessment of anxiety and autism. We happen to be collecting data using the SCARE, which is one of the instruments that Larry Scahill mentioned, which, as Larry mentioned, is verbally loaded. It has a parent and a self-report version. The data I'm going to present is the parent report version. We're not yet feeling like we want to run with the kid report for this instrument. So in the kind of neuroimaging studies that we do, I'll very briefly describe the kind of thing we have kids do. We have kids come in, they go in the MRI, they do a five-minute task. And in this case, this task happened to be a face identity task, and I'm going to describe later in a bit more detail. Faces are a really good way to get the amygdala excited. Five-minute task, you're perceiving faces. It's actually a face identity task. You see side-by-side faces. You press one button if it's the same person, another button if they're different. And then we have a control condition, which is not faces. It happens to be houses. And you look at activity in amygdala that's increased during the faces compared to the houses. And lo and behold, this is something I didn't necessarily predict some years ago when I started looking at this. Again, the sort of lore is you shouldn't see the amygdala doing anything in autism, right? You see beautiful amygdala activity when you present faces to people with autism, I find often. But if you look at this graph on the right, you see a ton of variability. So this is a sample of 43 folks with autism. There are no controls in this slide, or for that matter, the next two slides. All folks with autism. You see a ton of variability in amygdala signal during face perception. If you happen to be doing a study on these folks, you might show increased amygdala activity. Oops. If you happen to be doing it on these folks, you might show decrease. It might depend who walks in your door, but which is a very interesting point. So what we've found so far is that the magnitude, at least in the left amygdala, of signal is correlated with anxiety symptoms. It happens to be panic and separation anxiety, which is an interesting topic in of itself. I think the panic is more of the picking up more on the somatic aspect of autism rather than panic disorder per se. Important thing to point out is these correlations I'm describing here, which are pretty decent sized, they survive even when you co-vary out some core measures of autism, in particular the social responsiveness scale and the social communication questionnaire, which suggests that maybe there's some unique contribution to amygdala signal to be found when you consider anxiety. Okay, I want to move quickly through these data slides and yet still do them justice. Okay, so the study of amygdala volume in autism is something that's been going on for a very long time, and there's actually, in the past few years, some very interesting papers talking about trajectories of amygdala volume. We've started to look at this in autism, where I think we're at a very early stage at this point, but already we're seeing some correlations, incidentally negative correlations, between anxiety and amygdala size. So the more anxious, in these samples of 20 and 19 kids, the more anxious you are, the smaller your amygdala is. There's a lot, I really want to emphasize this preliminary data. There's a lot more analyses we need to do, and for that matter, a lot more subjects we need to include. But these actually sort of popped out right away, so I wanted to present them. Again, when you consider anxiety, you may start resolving some of these questions about the functioning of these symptoms in autism. One last data slide, which Lauren Bradstreet presented, and she's here on Thursday, in a poster. We've been looking at white matter integrity as well. Connectivity is obviously a big part of the picture in autism in general and in this narrative about anxiety. In this study of 94 folks with autism, we found a correlation between fractional anisotropy, which is a proxy for white matter integrity, a negative correlation between fractional anisotropy and in this case separation anxiety symptoms in a part of the brain in a white matter tract called the cingulum, and this is an illustration of it here, that connects the anterior temporal lobes to the frontal lobes. So it's directly behind the amygdala in both hemispheres. It's not a very large correlation, but it's a significant correlation. Again, adding to this narrative, okay, maybe what's going on in these anxious kids with autism is some sort of dysregulation of amygdala and prefrontal cortex. All right, those were kind of meant to be teasers about the possibilities of considering anxiety and unpacking what we know about the neurobiology of autism. I want to talk a little bit about future directions and considerations. There are a lot. It was actually kind of hard to make this slide because I could make it five slides. I'm going to make it one slide. there's so many caveats to doing work in this area. One of the first ones that came to mind for me was an interesting thing about the study of those brain structures I talked about in anxiety is most of the studies looking at anxiety disorders in kids and adults, fMRI studies, use faces as stimuli. And it shouldn't be horribly surprising as it happens, faces are one of the best ways to tweak the amygdala and get signal from it. Which it doesn't have to be the case. You could think of more powerful stimuli. In fact, there's a meta-analysis about this that came out a few years ago. There's studies that present horribly graphic stimuli to people. There's something called the International Affective Picture System, which is a set of over 1,000 photos that range from every conceivable topic, and some of them are mutilated bodies, things like that. You would think that would get the amygdala. Faces often do better. And that goes right back to this idea that faces are affective, and they may not be the most hyper-arousing stimuli, but they have this sort of social contact, this social component that the amygdala really resonates to. But we know that people with autism perceive faces differently. So there's this whole literature on anxiety disorders using faces as a listening stimuli. But we know that people with autism, it's been presented probably many times over the past few days, how folks with autism do different things when they look at faces than folks without autism. I don't think this is it's one of those problems. It's not like this problem is any different than any other kind of research. In autism, you have to account for this somehow. You have to do eye tracking. You have to somehow try to account for variability in how kids with autism perceive faces. But as someone trying to come up with experiments to look at this, this is front and center in my mind about how are we going to probe emotion? There are lots of different ways to probe emotion. One of the best ways, other than presenting face stimuli, is to actually do a mood induction. You know, think about the challenges of doing a mood induction on a kid with autism while you're putting them in a tube. It's a lot to think about. So those sorts of considerations. And the fact that I think this is often forgotten. You know, it's easy for people like me who go and crunch the numbers and had spent a lot of time writing code to think about this as some sort of peer manipulation. But you have to stop and think about what you're having kids do. You're having them go, like I said, you're having them go in a tube. I don't know how many of you have had an MRI, particularly a head MRI, but even if you're not particularly claustrophobic, you'll have a minute probably when you go in there when you're like, what the heck is going on? This is not comfortable. I'd rather be anywhere else. And you have to factor that in. And this is appreciated to some extent in the affective neuroscience community, but of course in autism it presents particular challenges as well. And then the question of habituation is another issue that came up for me. It could be that the time course of amygdala signal is what we ought to be looking at. So, well, there's habituation on a couple levels. There's repeated MRI procedures. We often like to bring people back and scan them on different studies, maybe weeks apart, maybe months or years apart. You could bring a kid in who's anxious, and maybe the third time they do the MRI, you're going to have a different amygdala finding because they're more relaxed about the MRI procedure. You have to factor these things in. So there's sort of contextual habituation, if you will, and then there's the more neurobiological habituation of amygdala, which is something that's been studied a lot as well, which may be a part of the picture, and I haven't yet really addressed that. So, but the last consideration and future direction I want to think of is the need for a better model of amygdala function. Again, it's sort of funny for me to say that because it's something that you know, so much research effort has gone to studying in humans, but we still are faced with this fundamental problem that we have a part of the brain that appears to be involved in social affiliation as well as fear. I mean, on some level that makes sense, but we need to find a way to disentangle some of these signals, I think, if we're gonna push the field forward. And it's also a catch-22 because I feel like we need a better model of amygdala function to understand anxiety and autism, but I feel like studying anxiety and autism might be what gets us the better model. So that's something to think about. Okay, with that, I want to, good grief, 2 minutes. I want to quickly thank the many people who have helped out in this project, so many of them here in the audience, and I'm going to move fast. Okay, and I also want to thank the postdoctoral program at the Center for Autism Research. If you add up all the subjects I just described, I don't know, between 1 and 200, and actually add some of the ones Connor described, we're talking about hundreds of cases, multiply that by 3 or 4 hours of assessment, and multiply that by all the brain power it takes to figure out what's going on with these kids, and it's an absolutely enormous task, and I want to thank all the people that have been involved in that as well. Thanks. Okay, I love to comment on your wonderful talks. I'm going to refrain. I could bug you later. I want to open up the floor and see if folks have any questions for us. So we've got about 10 minutes here. So go for it.
I wish to thank all of you for a very, very interesting session indeed. And I would like to ask about anxiety in very, very young children around the age of 2. And what do you know about developmental trajectories in this behavior? Thank you. Any of you is good enough.
You know, I know less about that age group because actually a lot of the ways anxiety disorders are typically not diagnosed until a little bit later. So you would talk more about anxiety symptoms in young toddlers. There have been some studies that looked at anxiety symptoms in preschoolers with autism, and there you do see some increases in kind of avoidant behavior, shaking, trembling, distress in different situations. But that's a bit what we're limited to. So you're limited to these behavioral signs. signs that we think may be anxiety, but it's hard to really figure out what it is. That being said, there have been a few longitudinal, well, they're not longitudinal, they're cross-sectional, but they've looked at the rates of anxiety in children, preschool, childhood, adult, and later adulthood, and there is some indication that we're seeing a similar developmental trajectory, something that would support that this is truly anxiety as opposed to the pattern that we'd see in autism.
Two other quick points. Number one, we know that some anxieties are normal in young children. Separation anxiety is not abnormal in a 2-3-year-old. And the other point to note is the work of Jerome Kagan and others show that there are some children who have an anxious temperament that's declared fairly early in life and relatively stable. So it's one simple way to think about it is that same distribution could be laid over the top of children with autism, and we might be picking that up. We also might be picking up signal of normal anxiety that gets somehow amplified by the autism. Other thoughts or questions? Go ahead. Help them out. Bend down that microphone.
Thank you. Yeah, I want to raise the conundrum of serotonin because many years of working with individuals with ASD, I acknowledge I have used SSRIs and I have seen benefits. I acknowledge the evidence that was well presented. So my question is, going forwards, is it possible that the lack of findings has something to do with the variability, mm-hmm. Given that there is a lot of variability? I just find it so mystifying that in typical individuals who do so well on SSRIs if they have anxiety, and there's this very discrepant evidence in ASD.
Yeah, very complicated question, and a good question. And I'm not sure why we're getting feedback all of a sudden. But the first thing I'd say is in anxiety disorders or anxiety cluster in children with ASD and SSRIs, we have no data. We have no data. I think there's good reason to think they might work if the sample were selected that way. Second thing I'd say is this finding of hyperserotonemia, it is one of the most replicated biological findings we have in autism. But there are several buts. One is historically the sampling, which kids were actually sampled has changed over time. In the first findings, they were very narrowly defined, strictly defined, Connor autism, not this Connor, the other Connor. And so that's one thing. The second thing is that it's about a third if you use a cutoff of above normal. It's about a third, so it's not all of them. The last thing I'd say is with the citalopram study, we did look at the rate of hyperserotonemia at baseline, and it comes in right around a third, and we looked 9 ways to Sunday to find out, is there any difference in the kids that have this hyperserotonemia and the ones that don't? Very weak signals. They're very hard to find anything about them that's different. The only thing we could find, strangely enough, is that they had a little bit higher scores on anxiety. Now, I say a little bit. It was statistically significant, but it wasn't a big effect. And it's striking to me in writing that paper together with George Anderson how little we know about this subgroup with hyperserotonemia. They've been reported on over and over again, but there were no large papers, nothing even as large as our sample of 150, that described the phenotype that goes with it. So I think I agree with you. There's a conundrum, and if we think there's something there, we're going to have to do a better job of characterizing those subjects. Great question.
Rachel? really great talk. Thank you. I just had a quick question. I just wanted to get your experience using some self-report measures with kids with ASD. So, for example, we've been trying to administer the Children's Automatic Thought Scale, and a lot of our kids are just like, no, 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 no. So I wondered what your experience was with the, I think it's the NASSQ, if you could comment on that, and even some of the anxiety, like the scared and the mask, what your experience has been with kids.
So I let there be variance. There's a number of kids who, we watch them fill out all these forms. Routinely we'd have research assistants, not their parents, but research assistants sit with them to help them get through them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time there was also reinforcement to get them to do it. So they're going to get their prize after it's done, that right. kind of thing. And for some children it really did seem to be invalid. We didn't exclude those, we just threw them in to see if we had results anyhow. Mm-hmm. That being said, for the higher functioning kids and even sometimes kids with average or low average IQ, if they were engaged, it did seem that they were able to get the concepts. In some ways it seemed to have more to do with attention sometimes and engagement than how much they could understand. But looking at the literature, there are some studies that would tell you that the child report looked good, that they're, you know, there's huge variability even typically developing kids between parent and child reports. So some studies in autism say that it's about similar, and other studies have said we're not even going to present the child report data because we don't think it's valid.
We've had a lot of experience with the child report mask, and I guess it's sort of a two almost contradictory answers to your question. One is that we do see this general pattern of children tending to report low on the mask and certainly scoring in the average range a lot of the time by the conventional norms, which it's hard to believe based on observations and others' reports. But on the other hand, when you look at the pattern of elevations on the relative types of anxiety, separation and social and GAD and so forth, you actually see agreement between the children and their parents at about the same level in the typical population in terms of what's relatively higher. So even though the kids are saying I have overall low anxiety, you might say, but relatively my separation anxiety is higher than the other types of anxiety, just like my mom or dad said. So depending on the level of analysis, you either see this kind of concurrence at a typical level or, at the other hand, this kind of low overall intercept or average anxiety score, which we do think might partly relate to just a lack of understanding of these very wordy items on the mask. So we're not too enamored of child report at the moment.
One thing I just want to say too, clinically, this type of interview is exhausting for children on the spectrum. Yeah. It's just maybe some of the hardest questions you could ask them. So I think another thing to keep in mind is really limiting how you're going to collect this data so you can get the best mm-hmm. type of report possible.
Right. Just a quick follow-up. I was also wondering what your experience was like when you're measuring, taking these kinds of measures pre- and post-treatment. Some of our experience has been sometimes kids are reporting higher symptoms post-treatment than they are pre-treatment, and I think some of it's just related to their awareness of some of their internal states. I wondered if you'd found similar kinds of if you've had similar experiences.
I think a number of people have found that same type of finding. We had actually a different experience where both our control group and our treatment group declined on self-reported mask scores over the course of treatment, but other people have found what you're saying. I think it's probably likely, I mean, certainly a successful emotion education is going to heighten awareness of anxiety states that kids were previously unable to put into words, and that seems like a formula for increasing ratings for a certain proportion of the kids. Mm-hmm. Even if their objective anxiety decreased in some way, they might not be able to, put it that way at pre-treatment, so it will end up with this bizarre reversal effect. I think that's definitely a likely possibility.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, I'm a psychologist working with a wide range of children on the spectrum, and in a context where there's far more access to ABA treatments than there is to CBT treatment. And so I'm wondering if you have any information about the effect on anxiety after intensive behavioral therapy in children with autism.
ABA has been studied so frequently with single subject design approaches, with just a small number of group designs in the history of ABA research, that it has rarely been studied in the same way that we've studied it with these CBT studies, where we will give a diagnostic interview and various report measures and so forth. And typically, single subject ABA research identifies some individualized key target symptom areas and looks for change in those over time. And the group design ABA studies have never looked at anxiety disorder outcomes in children with autism, so it's kind of a big unknown, really. I think that there have been some single case design studies in ABA that have shown that specific anxiety symptoms like phobias can respond to ABA, which is not surprising because, of course, ABA would use extinction and habituation procedures that are essentially the behavioral component of CBT. But we know in our experience with ABA providers that usually the cognitive part of CBT is not provided in ABA, and leading to this problem with generalization that I had mentioned earlier. So it's untested, but I think there's definitely some doubt to be cast on the relative efficacy between the two types for anxiety.
Anybody else want to ask? Okay. Hi, I'm a parent of a 16-year-old. I'm a. I'm a parent of a 16-year-old girl on the spectrum. I'm a grantee from Autism Science Foundation. First I'll say my least favorite four-letter word, which is help. And the thing that I, my daughter personally has been on Risperdal and Prozac for many years, and I'm wondering if you've done studies as to whether they eventually stop working or just, you know, as adolescents, that all of that adolescence hormone stuff takes over regardless of the drugs.
I'm sorry, what drug?
Risperdal and Prozac. She's been on cocktail for many years.
And it's targeting?
Aggressive behavior, anxiety, impulsiveness.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just wondering, do these drugs eventually stop working after being in the body for a long time, you know, over many years? Have you done any studies on people who have had them for a long time?
So, again, multiple layer question. The first thing, we have to borrow from some other fields. In OCD, anxiety, depression, the SSRIs are often described as pooping out, to use the technical term. And with risperidone, we generally recommend at least a look-see every once in a while to see if it's still making the difference that you think it's making. Because if it's a it's a potent drug, it's a drug that we would want the child on for the least amount of time that they could be, that they need to be on it. And so we've done a couple of take away the drug studies. And then we've also done some follow-up studies a year later after they were on the drug. And we find that, number one, if you take the drug away 6 months for tantrums, aggression, self-injury, it'll come back in most cases. You go out a year and a half, and there are some families that find that they can take the kid off, and the pattern of those behaviors is not there anymore, and they don't need the medicine. Then there's another group where the medicine doesn't seem to be doing it anymore. You raise the medicine, you don't recapture the benefit. And that's a small group, but there is such a group. And finally, I think that there's a group there, you may be able to reduce the medicine and hold the same level of benefit, and so the exposure is just lower, but you can't take them off. So it's a clinical management question with whoever's prescribing you go over with carefully. And that's a fairly common combination.
Okay. All right.
One quick question.
One more question.
These kids who become activated or became activated in the Celexa study, I was wondering if they became activated right away. This was 38%, I think you said, or whether it was delayed. Mainly that, just the timing.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question because it's important question. It does tend to be early, and it does tend to be with dose increases, and that's why I say that the presence of activation doesn't mean you got to discontinue the drug. In fact, very few of the children in that study discontinued because of activation, but it was obviously a very common occurrence, and I would say generally it's in the first 6 weeks or so of treatment. Now, it doesn't mean it won't ever happen after that. It just means that's the peak time. And what you have to do with the longer-acting SSRI, you have to hold the dose for a day and resume at half the dose, and it'll calm right down.
All right. I think actually we should stop. I was going to say, if you want to come up and talk, I'm going to be here for a little bit after. If you have further questions, I just wanted to thank everyone for participating in this panel. There's some great talks, and I want to thank you very much for listening.